appeal out of the Hopewell Circuit Court. It was a probation violation. Judge, I think the theme of this argument is going to be notice, due process specifically, and a probationer's right to notice versus actual knowledge on the part of him or his attorney. And I think
Can I ask you that? Just two things that would help me wrap around this case. One is, by statute, we're directed to do harmless error analysis. And so you could have any number of violations, but unless the litigant can show prejudice, then we can't reverse. And the second thing at some point that would be helpful for me to address is this intimation in the record that there was some kind of verbal notification by the prosecutor to trial counsel.
Yes, sir. Well, Judge, first of all, this is a due process violation, and so I believe that this court can do a de novo review of it. Quite simply.
But that still doesn't answer the harmless error question. That says there's error. Was it harmless?
Well, in this case, Judge, the court specifically cited the Petersburg and Hopewell violations as a basis for giving. And remember, it gave the absolute maximum. It gave this defendant every single minute of his suspended sentence. And thankfully for
But what I'm looking at is, I mean, suppose you have a morning of trial Brady disclosure, right? Well, if counsel can navigate that, then, I mean, suppose it's a felony record by a witness that you can impeach them with. Then maybe that wasn't a timely disclosure, but if there's no harm, then we can't reverse, even though it might have been error. On the other hand, if counsel stands up and says, look, Judge, I need a continuance because I would have need to investigate this. I want to talk to this witness. This is what I would have done. So that's what I'm struggling with is, I mean, I'm with you that, the law is clear. There's this due process component here. But unless I can find some kind of harm, I mean, then can I reverse?
Judge, and perhaps I'm not understanding the court's question, where the court after the hearing says, I'm going to consider the two issues, Hopewell and Petersburg violations, that you complain you didn't get notice of. And I'm telling you, as I impose this sentence, those allegations are part of the reason why I am giving you the maximum sentence.
And that ties in, I suppose, to your argument that without this formal type notice, they can't even go there during the revocation. And
absolutely.
So therefore, when the court then says, I'm taking that into account, well, that's per se prejudice because it shouldn't have looked at it at all.
Absolutely. Had the court said, none of that other stuff matters, Mr. Mason, I find that these two new Prince George convictions are abhorrent behavior. And whether or not you did these other things, I don't even care. I'm giving you the maximum. I'd be stuck, Judge. I'd have to concede that point. But we don't have the middle ground, which is an ambiguity. We don't have a situation where the judge says, okay, having heard the evidence, I'm going to give you the maximum. And we all sit here scratching our heads going, I wonder why he gave the maximum. Was it because of this one? Was it because of all three? In this case, we have the benefit of the judge on the record saying, not because of one, not because of two, not because of three, but because of the cumulative effect of all of them, that's why I'm giving you the max. So I don't think it's fair for this court to go back and say, well, even though the judge said that, he might have given him the max for Prince George, so we're going to call it harmless error.
But given that trial counsel knew, was counsel in the Petersburg situation, and presumably knew the facts, knew all of that, you're not arguing that there's any indication in this record that his trial's probably not, his revocation proceeding strategy would have changed any?
I don't know, Judge. He clearly says on two separate occasions, I'm not prepared to go forward today on these allegations.
But gives no proffer as to what he would have done differently.
He doesn't, Judge, except he says on multiple occasions that I'm not prepared to do that. Now, what he does, Judge, and it's important to sort of put it in context because there's about a five-page area of the transcript where there's this exchange. He doesn't say that he's necessarily familiar with every aspect of the Petersburg case with respect to the probation violation. What he does is that he says, I don't have notice, I'm not prepared to go forward today. The judge says, well, I'm not hearing you say that you're blindsided. Now, anyone that knows Mr. Cosby knows that he's a very sort of cut-to-the-chase attorney, and he's one that's going to be very candid with the court. And I'm sure he's I'm sure it's in the transcript. He says, I'm not suggesting to the court that I'm completely blindsided. I mean, he was at trial. He was counsel in Petersburg. But if the record shows that the charges in Petersburg were ultimately null prost. So the fact that he was counsel alone and charges that were null prost, we don't know how much he knew or didn't know about the evidence that was going to be introduced at the probation violation. But what he's saying is, regardless of my knowledge, whatever I knew or didn't know about Petersburg, I'm telling you, I didn't know it was going to be part of this violation. I don't have notice of it, and I clearly am not prepared to go forward with it. The judge saying, the judge essentially changes the bar. Because the Commonwealth argues Logan, and which is a case where I think a continuance specifically offered a number of occasions. Would you like a continuance? Are you sure you don't want a continuance? I won't make you go forward today. You can have a continuance. The judge doesn't do that in this case. The judge says, no, you've got notice. And I'm going to come back to that point in a second because I think it's important.
Well, let me stop you there and ask you specifically about Hopewell. Because it seems to me that the Hopewell and Petersburg charges can be analytically viewed as very different. The Hopewell criminal proceedings were specifically referenced in a writing that was provided to your client prior to the hearing, correct?
Yes, sir.
And in fact, the objection at the revocation proceeding on proceeding with the Hopewell charges, as I understand it, was not lack of notice. It's resulted in two hung juries. Why don't you wait until we actually have a jury finish up those charges one way or the other?
No, sir, both. You're absolutely correct, that one prong. But it was also raised that we've not been given proper notice about that for the probation hearing.
And then one other question I have. At the end of your brief, the relief you request is reverse and dismiss. What would be the possible grounds for dismissing, even if we agree with everything you say, as opposed to reverse and remanding to allow it to proceed only on what was noticed and giving that Commonwealth either the opportunity to renotice or to initiate an entirely new proceeding based on the Petersburg charges alone?
And to answer the last question first, Judge, I understand the court's point. I think that where there's been a constitutional violation and he's been denied due process, I think the show cause proceeding should be dismissed. I can, however, understand that if the court agrees with my position,
there are a lot of retrials after constitutional violations,
that it would find it should be remanded. And so that's a fair point, Judge. I understand that. One of the things that the court mentioned that I think is important is the distinction between Hopewell and Petersburg. And this case is going to be a fantastic primer, whatever the court's opinion is going to be, because it does sort of step through. You've got clear notice of the Prince George violation. Remember, this is a violation report from a probation officer that says the probationer has new convictions in Prince George. So we clearly have notice of that. Then there's a paragraph in there that's sort of
starting into your rebuttal. So it's up to you. You have ample rebuttal. It's up to you how to use it.
I'll try to move quickly. He says, the probation officer says, as a note, there's a detainer filed against this guy for these charges. And I will let the court know, those charges were ultimately dismissed by the trial court during a jury trial. He did not let them go to trial. He found as a matter of law that the evidence was insufficient.
Well, that would be on Bite of the Apple 3. He found there was sufficient evidence twice.
Two of them mentioned in mistrial. But then we have Petersburg, which is the opposite end of the spectrum where there's no notice whatsoever.
What about that statement by the Commonwealth attorney that there, his recollection was there was some verbal heads up?
Doesn't matter. Under this court's analysis in Price, says that they're entitled, a probationer is entitled to the same notice as a parolee, and it's got to be written notice, and it's also got to be of the evidence going to be presented against them. And that's where the Hopewell notice falls short, is it says, hey, there's a detainer against this guy. To me, Judge, that says no more than, by the way, if you need to find him, he's never been released from his Prince George charge. He can be sitting in this jail because there's a detainer against him. It certainly doesn't say, we are going to present evidence in the form of, and it was jailhouse snitches that said something to him. But, Judge, my point being, it's notice is under Price and under Logan, in fact, the Commonwealth cites Logan to say that the court has found that you're entitled to notice. It doesn't necessarily matter what form that notice is. And we're willing to look behind the capias. We're willing to look at the probation officers. But it's still got to be something. And I would submit to the court that a probationer, and I know the court's got reason for this, and the statute has reason for this, but we've so tailored back a probationer's right to process, not necessarily due process, but to process. There are so many exceptions. There are so many things you can do in a probation violation that you can't do in a criminal case. So many protections that that individual has lost, that one of the few that remain is the right to say, you got to put something in writing ahead of time and tell me exactly what I'm walking into. And it is a due process violation, and it's akin to, the best example I could think of is a criminal defendant shows up for a grand larceny trial, and he's been indicted for grand larceny. And the prosecutor stands up before trial and says, Judge, we also want to charge him with breaking and entering. And listen, we've had a pretrial motion. He knows about the facts. His attorney's well aware. We've had an open discovery policy. He can't be taken by surprise.
And in terms of the ultimate fate for these folks, a lot of times a probation revocation is more significant than the criminal trial if you're going to walk away with a bunch of suspended time.
Absolutely.
So, yes, you get the conviction, but then in terms of the actual incarceration, often that bit comes at the tail end with a revocation.
It does. But that
certainly did here.
And that's my point. The fact that the attorney knows about it, the fact that it's sort of all the same thing, the fact that the judge says, well, you didn't ask for a continuance. We understand we bypassed the whole indictment process, but you could have asked for a continuance. That shifts the burden of due process to the defendant. And it also creates a huge problem for the trial court, because if we're going to say you could have asked for a continuance is a end around the due process requirement, then that becomes incredibly discretionary. I don't have to remind the court of the countless opinions that say, well, continuance is within the sound discretion of the trial court. And then you're talking about micromanaging ad infinitum. When is enough notice? Was the Friday phone call between the prosecutor and defense counsel? What exactly was said? What was the exchange of information?
We've got about 3 minutes left. It's
yes, sir, Judge. I'm going to save the rest for my rebuttal.
Thank you.
Well, good morning. May it please the court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The question in this case is, do we send this back for a redo based on deficient notice for two alleged violations of his suspended sentence? And the Commonwealth's position is no, that the trial court adequately handled these alleged deficiencies in the notice.
Well, when you say alleged deficiencies in the notice, you'll concede that our case law requires written notice, and at least as regards Petersburg, there was not, correct?
Right.
So
there was no written notice.
So,
I mean, I did want to point out in my brief that there was at least some suggestion that there was some sort of discussion with the Petersburg matter, but
it's not fleshed out,
and in all candor, and I'll just go straight to the Petersburg, and in all candor, it's probably inadequate notice. But what do we do? What the trial court did when faced with that situation said, well, counsel, we're going to proceed, and I guess if it gets to the end, you convince me you need additional time to respond to some of this, I can consider that.
But isn't that fundamentally different than what happened in Logan?
I don't think it's fundamentally different.
In our first Logan opinion, which is the one you cite, and given its tortured history,
yeah.
I wonder how much of it is actually still good. But assuming it is, we use the term, the court uses the term approbate and reprobate. You were specifically given the choice on three separate occasions. Do you want a continuance so he can be re-noticed? Or do you want to go forward today? And on three occasions in Logan, Logan's counsel says, we want to go forward today. Given the choice, that's what we pick. There's no choice given here. It's, I'll listen to you and consider it later if it comes up. It's, you have to ask for one, but he's never given the choice. And there, so don't we not have approbating and reprobating no matter what?
I mean, I don't think it's distinguishable on that. I think that the court is saying, we're going to go forward today. If you need more time to deal with this or you need a continuance, then I'll consider it.
But consider it is not a promise that it would be given.
No, it's not, but he is given the opportunity to remedy the situation, and he's not taken up the opportunity. I think it's more akin to a situation where the Commonwealth comes in and wants to amend an indictment, and the defendant doesn't ask for a continuance, then he cannot complain on appeal. I think that is the similarity here in this case, is that he's given an opportunity to remedy the situation.
But with those cases, if you change the nature of the offense, then you can't even amend to begin with. And so in terms of the underlying notice component, which is the function of an indictment, the defendant, so, you know, essentially has effective notice, because even though we're changing the statute, the evidentiary underpinning is the same, and presumably counsel's investigated that and ought to be ready to go. But if you don't have any notice to begin with, then maybe it is different from the indictment line of cases.
I mean, perhaps. I don't really have a response to that.
Mr. Campbell,
I'm just thinking aloud.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I understood you. You earlier said, and with credible candor, that you have the Commonwealth has a notice problem. Is that limited to Petersburg, or do you believe it applies to the Hopewell?
No, I think Hopewell is fine. I think that the letter from the probation officer is sufficient notice. I mean, the probation officers routinely put in their notices that defendants have these charges pending. I don't think the Commonwealth has to put in all the specifics of a specific charge in order for there to be sufficient notice. So I think my position is that the Hopewell charges, I think, are fine, and that the trial court was correct in finding that there was adequate notice of a good behavior violation with that charge.
The continuance solving the problem, requesting continuance solving the problem. I understand you're saying they had that available to them. Do you concede, given that the trial court statement relied heavily on the Petersburg charges, that we don't have harmless error in the sense that we could say that but for the error, he wouldn't have gotten all of the time?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to agree with opposing counsel on that. I mean, the trial court's ruling at the end is very clear that he considered all three of these violations important into his in his decision. I mean, I think he even actually says it normally the Prince George charges would result in a little bit of time, but you've also did this Hopewell stuff. You've also did this Petersburg stuff.
He seemed to lean on the Petersburg stuff.
What's that?
He seemed to lean on the Petersburg stuff.
He did. He did. But I will say that perhaps there's a harmless error analysis in this sense, is that it's harmless in the sense that trial counsel never brought forth a different argument that he would have made had had he been adequately noticed.
And since he was counsel there, presumably is familiar with the...
Yeah, he was counsel in Petersburg. He says on page 26 of the appendix, I know all about the Petersburg charges. So I think it's harmless in that sense, is that I don't think that he's presented anything different that he would have done.
Well, can we presume at least some prejudice, though, in that you may have several cases that are pending in various locations before the Court of Appeals at any given time. I presume that last night you studied for this one a little harder than you did for one that you might have in February. But if we told you that your February argument would be heard today, would you feel prejudiced even though you're counsel in that case?
Oh, yes, I would feel prejudiced. and I would ask for a continuance. So,
fair enough.
In the trial context, counsel can file a bill of particulars to get, you know, more information. Is there any such device for revocation hearings that would palliate a defective notice?
Something that the defendant could file.
I'm not familiar with one, but that's why I ask.
Yeah, I'm not either.
So that puts more weight on the upfront notice, it seems to me, if you can't then turn around and say, well, is this what you're going to prove or set out to prove?
I guess there's not a... I don't want to say there isn't, but I just don't think... I don't know of anything that the defendant can do if he says he has no lack of notice.
I guess pick up the phone and hope they returned your call.
I mean, I think it's not a perfect case. I mean, the Commonwealth obviously could have did a better job here in terms of the notice. And the question is, what are we going to do about it now? I mean, do we send it back for a redo, or, you know, did he have enough, you know, fair trial on this? Counsel for the defendant seemed to indicate that he knew all about this stuff. He just was arguing that there was a technicality here that he didn't get, that the Commonwealth didn't do things the exact right way. What do we do about that? And we would submit that the trial court adequately addressed this at the trial level, and it should not be sent back for a redo.
Thank you very much for your argument.
Just about
3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Yes, sir. Just a couple of points that the court brought up. First of all, with respect to amending an indictment, the court's exactly right. It can't change a charge to add an element. I don't even think the defendant can agree to that, because it's an element that the grand jury hasn't indicted on. Again, that's a due process right that the defendant has. But what's important about this case is there are some charges that can be amended, and then a continuance is extended. If the court, from the record, this is clear, though, this wasn't a case where the trial judge said, I'm going to amend the capias to include the Hopewell, to include Petersburg. At that point, counsel might have a position that says, well, now the onus is on the defendant. An amendment's been made. He's now been given notice before the proceeding. And if he wants to ask for a continuance, he can do that. But this court was very clear in saying, because the prosecutor wasn't arguing, he has been given notice of Petersburg by my phone call, of Hopewell by the letter. Counsel for the Commonwealth was arguing a bad behavior allegation is a blanket notice for all bad behavior. And the court specifically says, yes, I believe that. That is the case. And if
he's just plain rotten.
Well,
is that the notice?
Right. And I know the court is being somewhat joking, but it's important, because that's how low the bar would be lowered.
You need to be able to come prepared to defend these things.
Bad behavior, you're a bad guy, isn't enough to put you on notice of the ways you're a bad guy.
Although presumably, I mean, if you got one that broad, the one person who does know all the places where he has charges pending against him is, in fact, the person charged.
The defendant, yes, sir. But, Judge, as defense counsel, we're never required to rely on the information or lack thereof of our clients, Judge. And I guess the court's
right. Like, that's a good rule to follow.
It is, Judge. Judge, finally, the last thing I'll mention is, it wasn't a situation where this was being raised as a technicality by someone who was knowledgeable of everything about it. Trial counsel says, I'm very familiar with the Petersburg charges. We don't know what he knew about the exact evidence that was going to be introduced at the probable cause hearing, but I mean at the probation violation hearing. What we do know is that on two separate occasions, he told the presiding judge, I am not prepared to handle these allegations today.
Well, on the not knowing the specific evidence, if the initial letter had said, and there are charges pending in Petersburg for the following crimes, and we intend to seek revocation based on this bad behavior, would that have been sufficient?
I think it probably would have, Judge. It would have put at least an onus on trial counsel to familiarize himself with, or to be prepared with, the fact that that allegation was going to happen. I think it would have.
Thank you both very much for your arguments. Come down and greet counsel.